John chapter 16, we pick up in the midst of a longer discourse, uniquely found in John's gospel. This longer discourse takes place after the Last Supper, but before the arrest of Jesus. He's in the process of preparing his disciples for the next phase of God's redemptive plan, which is about to begin in earnest. He is about to be crucified, and 3 days later raised from the dead. And so beginning in verse 16 of John chapter 16, Jesus says this to his disciples, "A little while and you will see me no longer. And again a little while and you will see me." Some of his disciples said to one another, "What is this that he says to us? A little while and you will not see me. And again a little while and you will see me. And because I am going to the Father." So they were saying, "What does he mean by a little while? We do not know what he's talking about." Jesus knew that they wanted to ask him. So he said to them, "Is this what you were asking yourselves? What I meant by saying, 'A little while and you will not see me, and again a little while and you will see me'? Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn to joy. When a woman's giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come. But when she has delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. So also, you have sorrow now, but I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. In that day, you will ask nothing of me. Truly, truly, I say to you, whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he will give it to you. Until now, you've asked nothing in my name. Ask and you will receive, that your joy may be full." It's particularly verses 20 and 22 that we focus on this morning. That you will weep, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will be turned into joy. And so also you have sorrow now, but I will see you again. And your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. Jesus is talking, of course, about the tensions and the transitions between mourning and joy that are about to come to pass with his death and resurrection. It's a tension that in some ways is reflected upon in the Lord's Supper itself that we'll come to in just a moment. But what Jesus is saying immediately in the disciples' immediate future is that they will move from weeping to joy, even while the world will move, in one sense, from rejoicing to weeping. They, of course, in that moment were confused. They, of course, were still struggling, even though Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels by this point in the story had predicted 3 times at least that he would be betrayed, and that he would be put to death in Jerusalem and raised on the 3rd day. And yet even now, after the supper itself, in which bread has been broken and the cup has been given, even now the disciples, as Jesus tries to speak to them, are still confused. And so we deal with the tension of sorrow turned to joy, weeping to rejoicing. What is going on here? Well, in one sense, I think many of us get this. And John's gospel itself, throughout the course of John's gospel, this discourse being unique to John's gospel itself will give us glimpses and bits and pieces of how this dynamic plays out. And certainly texts outside John's gospel will do so as well. What will happen, of course, and that many of you already know this, is that after Fridays, the crucifixion's fear and fleeing, and denying and hiding, some women will have the courage and the loyalty to approach the tomb of Jesus on Sunday morning, only to have the mood of the situation completely inverted. Just a few pages later in chapter 20 of John's gospel, we'll read in verse 11 that Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. And twice John emphasizes she weeps. But verse 16, Jesus says to her in John chapter 20, "Mary." And she turns and says to him in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And what she will then do in verse 18 is she will go and she will say to the disciples, literally, John records it this way, "I have seen the Lord. I will see you again," he said. "You will not see me, and in a little bit you will," he says. And John records Mary saying to the disciples, "I've seen him." And he had said these things to her. And similarly in verse 25, just a little bit later in time, when Thomas, who was not present with the other disciples at the first appearance of Jesus to them, doubts, famously, his resurrection. Unless I see and touch, I won't believe. The other disciples were telling Thomas, we have seen the Lord. For a little while they did not when he died. Now they do. And similarly, verse 19, still in John chapter 20. On the evening of that, the first day of the week, the doors were locked because the disciples were afraid of the Jews. But Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, peace be to you. And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. And the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Weeping, giving way to rejoicing. Mourning turned to joy. Of course, part of what Jesus said as well was going to be going on in the midst of his death was the world was going to rejoice. Now, the world in John's gospel is typically negative. It is the world that rejects Jesus. John uses the world in a very technical and consistent sense. Going all the way back to the beginning of his gospel, John chapter 3. This is the judgment. Light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light, does not come to light, lest his works should be exposed. Later on, chapter 7. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. The world hates me, Jesus says. The world rejects me, Jesus says. John chapter 16, just earlier in this very reading that we're looking at this morning, verse 2, they will put you out of the synagogues. Indeed, Jesus says to his disciples, the hour is coming when whoever kills you will think he is offering a service to God. So in John's gospel, the world is consistently allied against Jesus. It will rejoice when it puts him to death. It will think it's done a good thing. They put a blasphemer to death. They put a rebel and a traitor to Rome to death. In fact, it's interesting, Luke 23, Luke's account of the gospel, remember when Pilate, trying to pawn off the responsibility and accountability of judging an innocent man himself because of the political mess he was in, tries to hand Jesus off to Herod because it was Herod's jurisdiction over Galilee anyways when Pilate finds out Jesus is from Galilee. And so Herod is at first glad to see Jesus. He'd wanted to see him anyways. But when Jesus won't play ball, when Jesus won't perform for Herod the way he wants him to perform, Herod and his soldiers, Luke tells us, treated Jesus with contempt. They mocked him. And they sent him back to Pilate. Verse 12, but Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day. For before they had been at enmity with each other. Political divisions are solved in the rejection of Jesus. The world rejoices, even as it mocks and rejects him. It's the same tone or the same idea later in the Bible when the same Apostle John, now writing the book of Revelation, God, in the vision he gives John, John mysteriously sees two prophets representing the testimony of the apostles, the witnesses that Jesus has left in the world. And the world will reject the apostolic witness. He will put some to death, of course. John foresees that in Revelation chapter 11. And in Revelation chapter 11, those who dwell on the earth will rejoice over the dead bodies of the prophets. And they will make merry and exchange presents because the two prophets have been a torment to those who dwell on the earth. The world, Jesus says, will rejoice. The world will not. And because the world will not, therefore the world cannot understand what it is that we are commemorating today. They will blaspheme it. They will mock it. They will ridicule it, as some of us have seen in the media recently, because they cannot understand it. And they will rejoice in their rejection of it. The world has no desire to look upon its own sin, which is why it destroyed Jesus. Jesus' death and resurrection only served to harden the world collectively in its rebelliousness, lest even now the world should acknowledge and confess the enormity of not just what it's done in its initial sinfulness, but what it's done in its rejection of God made flesh who dwelt among us. And so the world rejoices, even as we weep and lament over the death of the Lord. The world goes on in its debauchery and mockery. Its feasting and its revelry obscure what we do here. Our feast is both serious and joyful. A weeping that has also been turned to rejoicing. because our feast looks at the consequences of sin and death. And we recognize our shame and our guilt borne by Jesus. But we rejoice even as we eat his flesh and drink his blood and hope in his life. Isaiah saw a similar supper scene in Isaiah chapter 65, something that I think captures the dynamic that Jesus spoke and John recorded here in John chapter 16, something that helps us further comprehend the tension, the move, the transition from weeping to rejoicing, and the world's reversal from rejoicing to weeping when it looks upon him whom they have pierced. Isaiah chapter 65, beginning in verse 13, God speaking says this, "Behold, my servants shall eat, but you shall be hungry. My servants shall drink, but you shall be thirsty." Which is what we do here this morning. We gather to eat, we gather to drink. Not for physical nourishment, not for satiation and substance. We gather to eat and drink because we truly live by the grace of God and Jesus Christ. "Behold, my servants shall rejoice, but you, the world, shall be put to shame. Behold, my servants shall sing for gladness of heart, but you shall cry out for pain of heart and shall wail for breaking of spirit." The world doesn't look at what we are doing this morning and see the joy and the rejoicing in it. It only sees oddity and weirdness. It only sees foolishness, idiocy. "My servants shall sing for gladness of heart, but you, the world, shall cry out for pain and shall wail for breaking of spirit. You shall leave your name to my chosen for a curse, and the Lord will put you to death, but his servants he will call by another name." The name of the one in whose name we gather around this table this morning. Isaiah foresaw it. God revealed it to him. "And so that he who blesses himself in the land shall bless himself by the God of truth. He who takes an oath in the land shall swear by the God of truth. Because at this table, in this name, at this moment, the former troubles are forgotten and hidden from my eyes." This is the table to which we have gathered. This is the feast in which we are partaking. This is the moment in which weeping and joy come together, and the weeping is turned into joy. And so let us eat, and so let us drink.